What You Missed on the Curve with Michelle Martin and Bernard Lynn. Only on Money FM 89.3. Read with Michelle Martin.
When it comes to happiness, well-being and society, what matters for Singaporeans? That's the title of a new book launched today by Associate Professor Siokwan Tambaya and Su Jian Tan. Among the findings, that when it comes to Singaporeans' perception of economic well-being, more people in 2016 than in 2011 said they were comfortable when it came to buying items for basic needs and doing things they want to do. However, when it comes to making major purchases like a car or home appliance or paying for significant home repairs, more than half of Singaporeans said they were unable to do so in 2016, though this is an improvement from the number who said no, they couldn't make a major purchase if they needed to back in 2011. The two associate professors from the NUS Business School have clocked 20 years of ongoing research on quality of life issues. They started from the year 1996. It's time to welcome Siokwan Tambaya and Su Jian Tan, both associate professors at the NUS Business School. Welcome. Congratulations on your book. It's terrific. And among your findings that Singaporeans were less happy, enjoyed life less, and felt a decreased sense of achievement in 2016 compared to 2011. Which factors would you say had the greatest impact on Singapore's self-reported assessment of happiness?
Well, thanks, Michelle, for having us on your show. It's quite hard to try and figure out what exactly are some of the factors that are driving these indicators of well-being. What we do see is we provide a holistic picture, right? We talk about happiness, enjoyment, and achievement. Mm. We also have indicators of satisfaction with life in general, life in Singapore, aspects of living in Singapore. So I think we have to look at the picture on a whole and see what are some of the factors that are driving some of these sentiments. So we do see, for example, in terms of satisfaction with life domains, that there could be affordability issues, cost of living. These things have been coming up for the past few years, right, ever since we started the survey. And we also see satisfaction with significant relationships. Yeah, they've been holding, quite strong through the years. So we see that some of these things could be contributing to other well-being indicators as well.
Was there a clear pattern in terms of the relationship of education and your general happiness or household income and happiness?
Well, it's not exactly a causality issue that we're talking here, but we're looking at independent indices and trying to, look at individual differences across different households and age group, education, and we realize that actually education and household income do play a significant role in differentiating Singaporeans in terms of their satisfaction with life, satisfaction with living in Singapore.
So is it fair to say that those who are more educated were self-reporting greater levels of happiness?
Right. The general trend seems to be that way, that, as you have more education, and because in Singapore education and income is actually closely correlated, so you do see that trend, but it's not a straight upward trend up north all the way, because there are some jagged edges, and we do see certain inflection points among different income groups.
Yes.
For example, it doesn't mean that if you have the highest income, you're necessarily the highest in terms of happiness, because people in the middle income range, certain parts of it, will also have as high a level of income, happiness, as people who are in a slightly higher income group. Now, be careful when we talk about higher income, because we do have a different way of differentiating income. I think Siok will elaborate on that too.
Sure.
Would you like me to do that?
I would love to, because we're going to dive into the link between money and happiness in just a while.
Great.
Okay, I think when we first try to figure out which were the income levels we'll be working at, we are mainly looking at monthly household income.
Yep.
Right, not the personal household income.
Yep.
Also, because for our survey, we found that people, we gave them the option of declaring the income. And we found that more people, about 941 respondents, said that they were going to declare the monthly household income. So we want to have a good spread.
So you limited the pool to the people who did declare the income.
Yes. We had 1,503 respondents, but not everybody wanted to tell us about the income. So it's important that we look at low levels of income, and then we have a medium low, a medium high, and then a high level of incomes. Mm-hmm. And we use a household survey right, the 2015 General Household Survey, to figure out where should the cutoff points be.
Why is there such a dramatic dip between a household which reports between 4,000 and 5,000 and a household which reports between 6,000 and 7,000? It doesn't seem that big a gap in terms of economic well-being. I'm looking at this big dip here. So again, so households that report between 4,000 to 5,000 and then households which report 6,000 to 7,000, there seems to be this big dip in between. What would explain that?
It's actually very hard to tell. Yeah. What we can see is when we're looking at the graphs that you've mentioned, there it seems to be a trend upwards, a slightly gentle trending upwards. So if you draw a sort of a trend line through these graphs, you will see a trending upwards. That means the higher your income level that's reported, they also reported higher scores of happiness, enjoyment and achievement. But as Sujay mentioned, there are different points of inflection.
Yeah.
So we don't see an optimal income range.
And you can't explain the dips?
Because this is not exactly a causality kind of issue. So this is what they
this
have
is
reported,
the pattern.
Right? And we try to put the income together with the indication of happiness. So, of course, if we are able to follow up, like, what is it that you're so unhappy about, perhaps we can even, come up with some answers. But this is like a snapshot of what is the state of happiness or achievement or enjoyment for those people in different income groups.
Yeah, and it's just interesting, given the snapshot, to see that a household with $6,000 might actually report less economic well-being in terms of happiness or enjoyment or achievement than a household with much less.
Right, right. Yeah. This is what we try to understand, and this is some interesting indicators that we are trying to put forth to try to answer exactly the question about, does money really buy happiness?
Which we all would love answered.
Yeah, but there's no one particular level of income that says, okay, if you have this and enough, you're the happiest.
Okay. Yeah. So you studied Singapore in 2017 and, your earlier work was Singapore in 2011. Tell us more about what you see as the most significant differences in terms of the quality of life in Singapore compared to, with these two time periods compared.
I think, let me start by saying that as far as satisfaction with aspects of living in Singapore is concerned, the affordability issues about, affordability of cars, properties and all that, never change. We still see it as the top concerns. Then subsequently, we do see other slight changes here and there, but it's still about the cost of living issues, whether it's about the cost of houses, healthcare, things like that. So this is something that remains
a concern,
consistent between 2011 and 2017.
As mentioned by Sujay, we try to break down the satisfaction with life into different domains, and that's why she mentioned the different domains. It's easier for people to sort of conceptualize and answer the question, because these are all perception measures. So you're asking, why do people report this?
All subjective
this is,
as well, right?
Yeah,
right.
It's subjective and it's perceptual. So it's whatever people tell you, you take it at face value, that this is exactly how they feel about a certain issue. And to add on to what Sujay has mentioned, we also see, for example, that for well-being indicators, right, we talk about happiness, enjoyment, achievement, we see a decline in the means or in the indexes that we have been compiling through the years, which is not very encouraging because it's sliding downwards. And we also have a measure called psychological flourishing, which is a quite holistic measure about respect, about meaning, purpose, even as spiritual life, and different links to communities and so on. So that is quite quite a holistic measure. And we do see a decline in some of the scores as well.
And is this declining across genders? Is this gender neutral, the decline that you're seeing?
In fact, the gender effect is quite muted. Yeah, so in Singapore, when we talk about male and female respondents, we don't see a lot of gender effects. And the same holds for marital status, right?
Okay.
So in some cases, married people may report higher scores, and in some cases, singles might report higher scores. But definitely for just now what I mentioned about the well-being indicators on happiness, enjoyment, achievement, education and household income has the most impact. And just now we're talking about satisfaction with age and education. So depending on what the the outcomes are that are being measured. We have different demographic variables that seem to differentiate among segments of respondents.
I was just wondering if you could help explain, when it came to economic well-being, you asked four questions of your respondents, right? Do they have enough money to buy things they need? If you needed a loan, would you be able to meet the monthly commitment? But when it came to the next two questions, you asked, do you agree you have more than enough money to do what you want to do? And actually more people in 2016 said they have more than enough money to do what they want to do, right? 61% compared to 32% in 2011. But then when you ask, would you be able to make a major purchase? They said, no. Most said no, they wouldn't be able to. So doesn't there seem to be something that is, you know, needs to be reconciled? How can they believe they have more than enough money to do what they want to and yet not have enough to meet a major repair at home?
I guess it's a matter of interpreting what do you mean by more than enough to do what you want to do.
Because does that mean they have low aspirations?
I don't think that should be the way, because the other question that we asked seemed to have given them the hints to think along the lines of a car and properties. And if you know, in Singapore, these are really very expensive items. So if they think about that, then that really makes them think of, you know,
but this
their
was
own
a major
ability.
Repair, maybe.
Yes, major but repair would be like a renovation, you know.
Significant
kind of
repair,
thing.
But not buy a new house.
But a major, such as a car, you know, or pay for a significant home repair. Whereas if you think about more than enough money to do what you want, well, if you think about traveling, it may not be as prohibitive as buying a car, for example. So we tend to think of it as that way. Like, you know, it is something that is very personal, whereas the other aspect, it is more a family commitment kind of expenses.
Okay, so if we look at the general picture, again, you talked about things that remain consistent from 2011 to 2016, and that was concern about affordability, cost of living issues. Were there differences that stood out for you in terms of what people were valuing more to do with their sense of, you know, well-being in Singapore?
Okay, I think for the satisfaction with life domains, spiritual life came up as among the top five. And this is a totally new entry into the top five rankings. And unfortunately, marriage and romantic relationships fell out of the ranks. Totally.
Completely out of the range.
No. It went into sixth position rather than the amount.
But no longer the top five.
Yeah.
We do see some movements in terms of significant relationships.
Okay, we must explain this for the listener. So this means that your respondents didn't think that this was important, a contributor to their quality of life?
No, it's the level of satisfaction that they have with this particular domain.
Yeah.
So, for example, people are happy with the relationship with their children, with their parents, with their siblings, and with their spiritual lives, but not so satisfied in terms of their romantic and their
marital
relationships.
This is big. That's really significant. Very. My goodness. We are chatting with the co-authors of When It Comes to Happiness, Wellbeing in Society, What Matters for Singaporeans. The book was just launched today and you can buy it online. We'll share with you a little bit in terms of where you can get it in just a while. Now, the study looked at Singapore in 2016 when there were significant moves to sort of improve public happiness. There was baby goodie bonus bags. It was Singapore's 50th birthday. Every other day there was something to be happy about, you know? And yet people were less happy in 2016 than in 2011. Did you expect to see a spike in happiness given the Golden Jubilee efforts in 2016?
We did, yeah. That's the first time, well, not the first time, when we did the last survey in 2011, it was just after the watershed general elections. So at that time, during the general elections, the campaigning and so on, people were asking a lot of questions. They had hot-button issues about housing, transport, and so there was a different atmosphere at that time. And when we did the survey in 2016, this was collected at the end of the year, about October 2016 to February 2017, we thought, you know, the mood would be more positive after the Jubilee Year celebration and, you're right, the Pioneer Package coming in, people feeling that the government cared enough to give them the packages and the subsidies and needed to mitigate some of the medical costs.
Sure.
And market agency that did the data collection for us, we worked with them for the past survey as well. They're very reputable, very reliable. And they did tell us that towards the end of the year, when you collect the data, people have the bonuses, then the holiday mood, you might get a slightly buoyant sentiment, right? But when the data came back and we crunched the numbers and all that, I was surprised that they were not a bit higher than what we expected.
Another interesting insight.
Instead, we saw the slides. Yeah,
so is this the unhappiest that we've been in your 20-year study?
If we compare to 2006, right, which is actually, which is from another data set, is just at that unhappy level. So it's almost like an inverted V shape.
Maybe compared to 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Okay.
It was low.
Okay. So the study also showed that satisfaction, since we're talking about decline, satisfaction with democratic rights declined. Singaporeans generally dissatisfied with their right to criticize the government, dissatisfied with freedom of speech and the right to gather and demonstrate. For the listener, could you explain a little how satisfaction with democratic rights impacts happiness or life satisfaction?
Okay. Throughout the book that we've put together, we try to, as you mentioned, right, look at the different indicators of happiness and well-being, and we try to find correlates, right, to see what are some factors that may drive these outcomes. So one of them, as you mentioned, is satisfaction with democratic rights, because research has shown that in a democracy, ideally, right, democracies provide infrastructure and environment for people to thrive, right, to have freedom of speech and the freedom to choose the government. So citizens should be happier. In our survey, we have a satisfaction with democratic rights, and then we link that to the overall quality of life in Singapore. It has to be very contextualized because it's about living in Singapore, right? Mm-hmm. What is the democracy like in Singapore? What is the effect? So what we found was that the ratings, as you mentioned, declined, and the three that were very badly hit were the right to criticize the government, the right to freedom of speech, and the right to gather and to demonstrate. And what we found is that this has an impact on the overall quality of life in Singapore. Okay, so if you feel that you have a duty to vote and you have a good understanding about politics and the efficacy of your vote, that your vote counts, this has a positive impact. So when people believe that this is true and that I have the duty to vote and that my vote counts, it makes them feel good, right? But there's a negative impact on their overall quality of life if they feel that, okay, after I voted, I cannot influence the policy or the actions. And when the government officials, once elected, they don't care about or they pay attention or they don't pay attention to citizens like me. So these were some of the rights that have a negative or positive effect, mm-hmm. depending on which right it is. There was something about corruption as well. I'll just add it in. It's part of the findings we talked about in our book. Respondents generally believe that corruption was not a major problem. Okay, and they still believe that Singapore is generally, you know, corruption free. So this did not have an impact, right? Because they're okay about it, right? There's no like strong feeling about it. But I think what's happening is that, okay, beyond corruption-free, I think there's a bit more that we can do.
Yeah.
Right? It's the more nuanced type of perceptions about, do I have the right to criticize the government? Do I have...
And the fact that Singaporeans care about these things, the right to criticize, freedom of speech, right to gather, doesn't that fly in the face of that stereotype that Singaporeans are politically apathetic?
Yes, I think certain pockets are... like that way. Because if you look at our demographic analysis, the people who are really going to go to town on these will be, for example, for efficacy of voting, the citizens who are 25 to 35 years of age and with lower levels of education and income, they were the most skeptical. Mm. Right? And people who want to be empowered, males who are 25 to 30 years of age with medium levels of education, low incomes, felt the most disempowered. Mm. So we do see the sentiments maybe a bit stronger in certain demographic segments.
Okay, let's turn to a fun part of your findings, and that is Singaporeans don't seem to value fun and enjoyment in life.
Yes.
Too bad.
It's something that was very consistent since the last century. It was 1996 in which we first conducted, you know, this survey. So part of it could be that Singaporeans are quite shy about admitting that they really value fun and enjoyment and excitement. And the other aspect could be that they're so busy, you know, dealing with the bread and butter issues.
So again, this is Singaporeans saying this didn't contribute to their sense of happiness, or?
No, is the sense of importance.
Yeah.
Sense
of
is this value important to you? So we give them 9 values. They say, okay, now these are the 9. We didn't ask them to rank because that would be very hard. Mm. So just tell us, how important do you think these values are to you? Mm. So what we find is that fun and enjoyment seems, or excitement as well. Fun and enjoyment and excitement are 2 of the most lowly ranked values through
either
the years.
7, 8.
Yeah.
And what was the value that was highly ranked?
Security for 2011 and 2016.
That's why we're not having fun. They're so busy working for security.
Oh, the sense of security is that you want to be protected, right, from attack. And there's a fear. Right?
Comfort.
Mm. And the second one is self-respect.
Self-respect, self-regard.
Self-respect, and then the third will be sense of... The third one will be warm relationships with others.
Mm. Interesting to see what Singaporeans value when it comes to happiness. Now, professors, tell us, what do Singaporeans seem to want to happen in terms of change in life in Singapore? What do Singaporeans want the government to step up to do to make life happier in Singapore?
Yeah, that was one of the questions we asked, and we gave the respondents quite a long list of different areas, right? And basically the question was, if you wanted more resources to be put in this area, then tell us whether you agree with these statements.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So let me tell you what the 5 areas are. First is to address the needs of the aging population. 2 is to moderate rising prices. 3, to help the marginalized in society. The 4th was to improve the public transport system. Mm-hmm. And 5, to provide more resources for the population's healthcare needs.
Okay, so this is interesting, right? Because if we think that bread and butter issues are top of mind, but it seems that Singaporeans are more concerned with the aging population, how the government's addressing that, and how the government's dealing with cost issues. Yeah, is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, it is related to cost.
It is related, but because it's aging, specific though, right?
But it's still personal well-being in terms of the financial as well as the physical impact.
Hmm. Okay, and we'd love to have you on a little longer, but we're down to the last 60 seconds of the show. Can you share with us a little in terms of the future areas of research that you're going to... How long is this going to stretch? 20 years already?
we have good staying power. So I think we're going to try and do this for as long as we can. Yeah, and I think in future research studies, we'd like to maybe add more measures about meaning and purpose, maybe more post-materialistic values. We want to move beyond some of the value systems that we've been looking at. Mm-hmm. And ideally, we also like to gather more support from the government or from other academics so that we can perhaps have something that's more sustainable in terms of index. I think we enjoy doing this research very much.
Yeah, well, we've enjoyed hearing about it. As they say, what you don't measure, you can't change. So what's more important than quality of life? Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Michelle.
We've been speaking with the NUS Associate Professors from the NUS Business School, Associate Professors Siok Kwan Tambaya and Su Jian Tan. The title of their book, Happiness, Wellbeing and Society, What Matters for Singaporeans, and where can people buy it? Online.
You can buy it online. I think the Routledge website, Amazon.
Yes, yeah. And 20% discount.
Oh!
Wow. It will be in the bookstore soon.
Terrific. Well, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.